Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we are talking about the proposal to do away with the death penalty currently under consideration at the state legislature. Also, the Romney-Trump detente, if you can call it that, the additional money available for the state budget next year, and a recap of Utah at the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Joining me for this conversation this morning is Salt Lake Tribune Justice reporter Jessica Miller. And good morning, Jessica. You're the only one here so far.
I am the only one here.
We're waiting for a couple of other reporters to come in, and we'll see if that happens or not based on weather. I think they're probably delayed. Listeners, you can join this conversation with your questions, your comments. Call us at 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. So, Jessica, the push to end the death penalty here in Utah. Mm-hmm. Before we get into this year's efforts, maybe you could give us a bit of the background here. Eliminating capital punishment is something that has been tried before at the legislature, right?
Right. So 2 years ago, Utah legislators came close to abolishing the death penalty in 2016. But the bill passed out of the Senate, but never reached the House floor before the midnight deadline. Last year, there was a bill that would study the costs of the death penalty in Utah, but nobody tried to bring another bill to abolish it. So this year, actually, there's both bills now. There's a bill to study the costs and a bill to abolish it. So we've got these two bills here now. So
we'll talk about both of them this week. As you said, though, there's a push to one of the bills is to ban the death penalty. It's a renewed push to do this, and it's a measure by Republican Representative Gage Frohr of Huntsville. What does his bill say?
So the bill's pretty simple. It just basically would make it so that prosecutors can't seek the death penalty after May. It doesn't affect the current cases that are currently in the court system, and it won't affect the 9 men that are on death row right now. So this is kind of a moving forward, no more death penalty.
Okay. And this is coming from someone who was, in the past, a proponent of the death penalty, right?
Yeah. He said at a press conference earlier this week that when this bill came up in 2016, he was actually against it, wanted to keep the death penalty in place. But then as he looked at it, looked at the costs that are being spent, looked at, you know, he's pro-life. And so the argument that this is or abolishing the death penalty is a pro-life argument, he kind of changed his mind and now supports repealing the death penalty.
And, you know, maybe a sign that things have changed this year, House Speaker Greg Hughes, he threw his weight behind this measure. And I actually have a clip of him here at a press conference. And this is courtesy of KCPW producer Emily Means, who tackled this topic pretty in-depth on her show In the Hive this week. Gratuitous plug there. This is Greg Hughes at a press conference on Tuesday with what he says is a conservative argument against the death penalty.
For a conservative who understands that government can make mistakes, is not perfect, certainly isn't perfect in everything that it does, it should bring us pause that kind of penalty is available. And that if, in fact, government is not perfect, then inevitably and statistically, government would get it wrong. And that's something that I don't know that we should all be comfortable with.
And again, Jessica Miller, Salt Lake Tribune justice reporter, Greg Hughes there making actually just one of a couple of conservative arguments there in support of doing away with the death penalty. How important is the speaker's support to this effort this year on the Hill? I mean, is it going to make a big difference? It hasn't been something that he's been, I think, doing in the past, has it?
I don't think this is something that he supported in the past. I'm not sure how it will affect.
Right.
That's a great question for someone like
Robert
Gerke.
Come on, Robert, get here.
If he got here, he might know, but...
Okay, that's a good point. You know, and it's, well, to me, it's an interesting one because he's one of a couple of prominent Republicans, of powerful people in Utah who are making the case for doing away with this, and... you know, we'll get to the voices that are against this measure momentarily, but I also want to mention that the Governor Gary Herbert had some comments on this as well. I attended his monthly news conference, which airs on KUED-TV, and this is part of what Governor Herbert had to say about this renewed push to eliminate the death penalty. Just to set this up, he started out by saying that historically he, too, has been in favor of the death penalty, but then he used the maxim, justice delayed is justice denied, and here's where he went from there.
Not only is it unfair for those who are being prosecuted, but I think it's really unfair and unjust to the victims, as that constantly, the appeal after appeal after appeal ad nauseum. kind of reopens the wound that they have to live with. So I'm to the point of saying for the taxpayer and for justice, it certainly is less expensive, I think, by all accounts, to have life without possibility of parole as a replacement for the death penalty.
Okay, so life without a possibility of parole. He also went on to say, Herbert went on to say that he would consider signing this, Jessica Miller. And so we've got, you know, the House Speaker, the Governor, and again, maybe it's a new day in Utah on this topic. And I'm wondering, this is a hard one again, for I think for you to answer because you're a reporter, but is this part of a new trend in conservative politics in the Republican Party even? And we can get to that, but are there more? Is there more Republican support of doing away with the death penalty than there has been in the past?
I think there's definitely been a shift. You know, another notable person who spoke at the press conference earlier this week was Brett Tolman, who was the former U.S. Attorney for Utah, and he said, you know, when he was a prosecutor for 10 years, he was very pro death penalty. But as the years got on, and he spoke with a lot of the victims in these cases, a lot of them didn't want the death penalty or didn't realize what it would mean to have decades of appeals and to have to, you know, reopen that wound and talk about the case year after year. And every time an appeal comes up, it's in the news and this killer becomes famous. And the people don't really like understand that. So it seems like there's definitely been a shift with conservatives changing ideas about the death penalty.
Part of that has to do with costs, essentially, and some studies looking at costs. And maybe we'll get to that in a second, because there are some legislative opponents to this idea as well, and among them is Clearfield Republican Representative Paul Ray, who is a longtime proponent of the death penalty, and he says that this is a bad idea and that he has the data to back that up. And more audio here, courtesy of KCPW's program In the Hive. Here's Paul Ray making just part of his case against Representative Frohr's bill.
Well, I think you'll see an increase in attacks and deaths on correctional guards. I think you will see an increase in cost of housing these individuals. You will see unlimited appeals. Everybody will go to trial now because there's no reason to plea. If the maximum you're going to get is life without parole, and that's what it's going to be, why not? There's not a reason to plea down. You know, it really is a deterrent in a lot of ways. It may not stop somebody originally from, I mean, murder is a crime of passion. You know, that's, they don't think about the end results. But once you get into the system and you're sitting in prison and you think that you're scot-free to do whatever you want now, having that death penalty over your head is a big deal.
Okay, and again, Jessica, that's Representative Paul Ray there. The argument there that he's making is essentially that, well, one of the arguments that he's making is that people behind bars as a result of this will be free to
keep killing,
be more dangerous. And is that one of the arguments that has prevented the passage of this in the past when a measure like this has reached the House floor or has reached a vote in the legislature?
I think that that's one reason. I mean, you look at, there's at least one person on death row right now who is in that situation. He was in prison for murder and then he killed someone again. And there's a pending case similar to that. So I think that's a big argument. The other one is, you know, lawmakers have a hard time pushing this bill forward when you have victims' families come and say, we want this option and we feel like this is justice. And why would you take this away from us if this is how we feel like we can get justice for our loved ones? And so it's a really emotional topic and a difficult one.
You know, I want to get to the comments of family members of victims here in a minute, because there were family members of victims who were testifying on both sides of this. Those, as you said, who said this is justice. Others who said, I'm not comfortable with this action being available. But I want to go, I want to bring, welcome to the conversation here, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Also news editor, that's government editor, Dan Harry. Welcome as well to you. And a question that I posed to Jessica, Robert, that she was reluctant to answer just in her position as reporter, is how important the support of House Speaker Greg Hughes is in the effort this year to try and abolish the death penalty in Utah. I don't think it's something that's been part of the conversation in the past.
Right. Well, he's expressed support for the legislation in the past, but the fact that he's supporting it probably means that it gets moved up a little bit in the order of things, right? Because we are kind of running out of time in the legislative session, And we saw this bill come out and then was in a committee just within a day or two. And so I think his support is important there. And, you know, I think it maybe gives some of the House members a little bit of cover when somebody who's, you know, the highest profile member of the House is out there supporting this as well. So, you know, I think it's important. I think that when we've had this debate before, Senator Steve Urquhart was able to get it through the Senate and it didn't get a hearing in the House. And so obviously we're seeing it start in the House this time. It's got its hearing. It passed out of committee, and so we'll see where it goes.
Awaiting a vote in the House is where we are right now. It's come from committee, but it'll be on the House floor in its next
probably within next week.
Okay, a kind of uncomfortable but still important part of this debate has to do with the costs, right? So you've got. Is it more, you know, it's more expensive to keep a person on death row going through the appeals processes than it is to just sentence them to life in prison. That's what advocates of getting rid of the death penalty say. Representative Paul Ray, who we heard from just a moment ago, essentially contests those numbers, doesn't he?
Right. So it's actually a really difficult question to answer, the cost difference between the two. There's a lot of different things that need to be measured. Legislative analysts in 2012 estimated that a death sentence and all the appeals cost $1.6 million more than just a life without parole sentence. But Paul Ray kind of takes exception with that because it didn't include things like end-of-life care, and there's a couple of other, you know, costs to the courts and other things that weren't considered because it was a pretty it was just an estimate. It wasn't, you know, a huge study. So how much it actually costs in Utah, I don't think that's actually really been figured out yet. It's a difficult thing to try to measure.
And part of the difficulty in trying to pin this down is we have so few cases to refer to, right? Mm-hmm. And they all tend to be kind of unique in their own way as well. And the end-of-life care, the argument there is there is some validity to that, because if you're going to keep these people there until the end of their lives, they're going to have chronic terminal conditions at the end, you know, near the end, and the state ends up paying for those as well. Conditions that Representative Ray argues they're not going to have if they're executed, right? But we've also seen in some of the cases where people have been executed that they have chronic and terminal conditions now. And again, it goes back, there are such rare instances where we have put people to death in this state that I think it's not going to be a significant cost factor to, you know, care for these people at the end of their life.
He did. Representative Ray also talked about fewer plea deals being struck as a result of this, because there's that bargaining chip isn't there, essentially.
Right. Yeah. The Attorney General's office, someone from their office spoke at the committee hearing and said that he estimates that about 3 cases a year in the last 5 years or so have pled out to life without parole sentences. So if you don't have that bargaining chip, then that's 3 more cases a year that are going to go to trial, because what does the defendant have to lose if he just goes to trial and then gets life without parole anyways?
Okay. You know, there's a lot that we haven't touched on. Victims' families, for example, there were family members, as we said, of murder victims who spoke both against and in favor of this proposal. Who were they and what did they have to say, Jessica?
So on both sides, kind of the argument is like, what is justice? You've got, you know, a woman whose sister was murdered who said that she felt like her family got justice when they walked out of the courthouse and they knew that the killer was going to be in prison for the rest of his life, and that was justice. They didn't have to sit through 20 years of appeals. And then you have, you know, a man whose aunt was murdered in a horrendous cabin break-in in the 90s, and that man's still on death row, and they worry that if this bill passes that would open up a new avenue for an appeal for this current death row inmate. And so for them, justice would be letting this process play out and having this person executed.
I'm going to go back to Robert Gerke, actually, on this. Deciding what constitutes justice is, you know, a hard thing to do if you're not a victim of the crime. Or a family member of the victim of the crime. But there, you know, even the governor at his press conference this week said that the chance that the courts might get it wrong is reason for pause, reason to reevaluate this. Is that also one of the reasons that maybe there's more of a chance this year than there has been, because there's more data about potentially the justice system getting it wrong?
Well, I mean, we've seen cases even in this state where people have been wrongly convicted and spent a lot of time behind bars. In my column this week, I referenced Deborah Brown's case. She spent 17 years in prison for a murder that she was later proven that she didn't commit. And so when you're dealing with capital punishment, it's bad enough that she spent that much time in prison. It would be much worse if she had been put to death and then, you know, well, sorry. So I think it is something that is it weighs into the whole equation. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, as Jessica mentioned, there's a lot of components to this argument. It's very complex, and that's why it's been an argument that we've had in this country for decades now.
Dan Harry?
I think one case that always kind of is exhibit A2 is the Lafferty brothers. Mm-hmm. So the Lafferty brothers committed a horrendous murder of their sister-in-law and niece, an infant niece. And one brother, Dan, was sentenced to death, and Ron, his brother, committing the same crime for the same crime, sentenced to life. So really, that kind of raises the question of what is justice.
In my column this week, excuse me, as well, I talked about Joseph Mitchell Parsons, which is an execution I witnessed back in 1999, and he was convicted. He'd been a hitchhiker, had just gotten out of jail or out of prison in Nevada. He was hitchhiking across the country. And got picked up and killed this guy, the driver who'd picked him up, dumped his body, stole his wallet, because he'd had a prior record and because he was in rural Utah. Basically, he ended up getting the death penalty. It's a type of crime we see pretty frequently around the rest of the state, especially in the urban areas of the state, and we don't see people get the death penalty for that. So there is a geographic randomness to the death penalty, I think, that needs to be addressed. And also, you know, you get other factors in there: race, socioeconomic class, the quality of the counsel that these people are, the representation these people are getting when they go to court. So there's all these random factors, and I don't, my own opinion on this is I don't think there should be that randomness when you're dealing with something that is life or death, literally.
Robert, I know that Dan doesn't make predictions, and speculative journalism is kind of
my job.
It's cheap, but it's it would seem like this has maybe more of a chance than it did back in 2016.
Yeah, I think it does, and I think I don't know where it's going to come down in the Senate if it gets that far. I think it's still got a tough road in the House, but I think it's important that we're having the discussion this time, and maybe in a little bit more detail than we have in the past. And I think there is potential for it to get out of the House, and then who knows what happens.
Jessica, again, we're just waiting for a vote on the House, and then it has to make its way through the Senate. And it had a less of a rough go in the Senate the previous time around.
Right.
Okay. Okay, Representative Gage Flores, House Bill 397, we will see in the next 2 weeks if it does better than its 2016 counterpart, which got pulled at the last minute. Thanks to Jessica Miller, Salt Lake Tribune Justice Reporter, for this. It's time for our first break of the show. When we come back, a bit more from the legislature and the much friendlier words between President Trump and Mitt Romney, marking a kind of change. We'll revisit some old but not that old audio clips as well when we come back. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, justice reporter Jessica Miller, and news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup. Join us with your questions and comments, and you can do that by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or posting at sltrib.com. Let's actually move away from the legislature for a little bit and duck into a story about Mitt Romney, who, of course, is running for Senate here.
What?
I know. Shocking. Who knew? And, well, it would seem like he's maybe made a new friend, Dan Harry. President Donald Trump tweeted out his well wishes and his endorsement for Romney this week, and Romney gladly accepted, and then peace broke out around the globe, and we all sang kumbaya. I've told the basics. What did Trump and Romney have to say?
Well, you know, everyone was kind of waiting to see how these two will interact with one another. They've had a very rocky road. Trump endorsed Mitt Romney in his 2012 presidential campaign. And then later, when the blood turned bad between the two, Trump said that Mitt Romney had begged for his endorsement. Mm-hmm. And then he criticized him for choking like a dog in the election, losing to Barack Obama. And of course, Mitt Romney, for his part, during the primaries in 2016, called...
You know what? Hold that thought, Dan, because I've got some audio here.
Well,
here's two instances. I'll have you answer the question I asked you in a second, but here are two instances of Romney and Trump finding fault with each other. The first is Romney on March 3rd, 2016 at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, an excerpt of a longer speech and not the clip you normally hear.
Think of Donald Trump's personal qualities. The bullying, the greed, the showing off, the misogyny, the absurd third grade theatrics. You know, we've long referred to him as the Donald. He's the only person in the entire country to whom we have added an article before his name. And it wasn't because he had attributes we admired.
That's Romney. And then here's Trump 2 weeks later at a rally in Salt Lake City, mind you, before he secured the Republican nomination.
I have many friends that live in Salt Lake. I have a lot of friends. By the way, Mitt Romney is not one of them. Did he choke? Did this guy choke? He's a choke artist. I can't believe. Are you sure he's a Mormon? Are we sure? He choked. It was so sad.
Dan Harry, that's the history. But I'm guessing, things have changed since then. And what has changed? I don't know if that's a question for you or for columnist Robert Gerke.
I'm not sure if anything has changed. I don't know if we know that's the case yet. So they've gone back and forth. And in fact, there are a lot of people that are sort of hoping that Mitt Romney becomes the Trump foil in the Senate. And that's to be seen. Mitt Romney, in an interview with our Thomas Burr the other day, Washington correspondent, said that Mitt will call them like he sees them. He says he supports the president's domestic agenda, but when he sees something that he thinks is off kilter, is racist or misogynist, he said he will call them like he sees them. So we'll see how that goes.
They both kind of stand to benefit politically at this moment from making amends. Is that what it comes down to? And maybe that's a Robert Gerke question.
I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, I think it doesn't do Trump any good to try to keep picking a fight with Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is in all likelihood going to win this election and be the next senator. So it's an olive branch, I guess. And, you know, we'll see if they start beating each other with olive branches or if it turns, you know, or maybe they're going to, again, as you said, sing kumbaya and have peace break out. Because I think there is sort of this tense detente right now. And from the sounds of it, the Trump people are not out looking for a candidate to take on Mitt Romney. So I think they're kind of resigned to his coronation, and recognize that they're going to be better off working with him than fighting with him.
Dan, there are factions within the GOP, as you pointed out, that have wanted to distance themselves from the president. Is there any risk to Mitt Romney going, you know, kind of the opposite direction here and being as friendly as he is to him or at all?
Well, I don't think we know how friendly he is to him yet. Like, as Robert said, you know, Trump sort of had to endorse Mitt Romney. Unless his political advisors are completely blind, they know that Mitt Romney is likely going to win this Senate seat. So it makes no sense to go into it with an enemy. If you look at Trump's history, I mean, unless you're a relative by blood or marriage, the likelihood of you staying an ally of his very long is not good. I mean, some of the folks he brought into the administration and that were seen as closest to him, even including now Attorney General Jeff Sessions, are regularly trotted out as his whipping boys. So. It's tough to predict how this is going to go.
If I could just sort of elaborate on that, I think from Romney's standpoint, it doesn't do him any good during the election, during the primary, to go out and beat up on Donald Trump either, because Trump, particularly in the Republican, his approval rating is only about 45% in Utah overall, but he is popular among the Republicans, and he's popular in rural Utah, and those are areas where Mitt Romney is still going to need to get some people's support. So going out there and hammering Donald Trump is not going to be beneficial to him either.
Meanwhile, Romney is on a sort of listening tour of...
Well, he drove a tractor. Did you see that the other day? He was driving a tractor in northern Utah.
Probably
so
looked like Michael Dukakis in a tank,
right? That rural vote
now
is in the pocket, so...
Okay. Kind of reintroducing himself to Utahns is the idea of this tour, I guess, or maybe for the first time for some of them.
Probably for him, frankly. I don't know. I don't imagine he's actually been in, around rural Utah much, but
hunting varmints, I think, is a few times.
I could ask about the polls, but I think that they're probably extremely predictable. Let's move on to other stories. And Dan, let's drop into another political story, actually, just for a moment. This is much more local. This is that Salt Lake Democratic Senator Jim DeBacus is calling it quits after this term, at least calling it quits up on Capitol Hill, as far as we know. What's the story here, Dan?
So Jim DeBacus is sort of the most entertaining legislator we have. And Democrats, I think, sort of have mixed views of him because, you know, some of them see Jim as sort of over the top and alienating the Republicans who control the legislature. But many feel that, you know, he really is the only one that is free to express his true opinions in opposition to the Republicans. Interesting thing that I didn't know about Jim, although he's probably talked about it. He's talked about a lot of things, is that in the campaign reports, I was going through them for something else and noticed that he's the only senator I found that doesn't take campaign donations from corporations or PACs. Every donation that he had listed was from an individual person. You got to kind of admire that, and it does show that he's got some real support, not among industry or, you know, special interests, but among people. And I think that that's a loss that's going to be felt when he's not up there with his vocal brand of partisanship.
The reason he gave is just time to hang it up. I mean, what did he say?
Yeah, that's kind of what he said. He's been in the Senate now for 6 years, and he said he believes in the concept that you are, you know, you're a private citizen. You come into public service. You serve for you give it your all, basically, for as long as you can, and then you step down. So it sounded as he kind of running out of energy is the way that I read that.
There's rampant speculation about what he'll do next. And I should, for disclosure's sake, say that DeBacus is one of the hosts of the KCPW political show, Both Sides of the Aisle. Speculation among his co-hosts on that program this week, Representative Dan McKay and economist Natalie Gochner, is that he might run for Salt Lake City mayor. Again, news editors, don't speculate. Over to you, columnist Robert Kirky.
I think we asked him about that. He didn't say no. He said he's not thinking about that right now, but I think that there's certainly a possibility that he'll do that. I would even suggest maybe a likelihood that he would. There's been some tension between him and Mayor Biskupski, and maybe some disappointment, I guess, from DeBacus, who endorsed the mayor when she was running. So I think that's certainly a possibility. It's also possible. I mean, he until he's kind of got in and started running the party, I don't think he was even all that involved in politics. You know, he did not run for office and was sort of an outside. I mean, he was involved in the sense that he moved in those circles, but he hadn't run before. So maybe he's done.
Yeah, I think he was sort of a behind the scenes mover and shaker too. He was intimately involved in negotiating a deal that allowed the LDS Church to endorse Salt Lake City's non-discrimination ordinance. And that was the first one in the state and kind of started a chain reaction that ended up in the state law modeled along the same lines. And DeBacus facilitated that agreement. And so, you know, he's kind of an activist that's been around for a while.
I want to just quickly, to close this out, you know, go back to something that you said, Dan, about a certain feeling among some Democrats having to do with Senator Jim DeBacus that he's, you know, he gets flack for being too bombastic, might be the word. I'm wondering, though, if in a supermajority Republican state like Utah, if those theatrics aren't a form of power, and this is probably, again, a question for Robert, that the Democrats wouldn't otherwise have. I mean, being able to say whatever you want.
Right. When you're a Democrat in the Utah legislature, you can approach your job one of two ways. You can go in there and you can try to play ball and see what scraps you can get, or you can, you know, go in there and break dishes and, you know, throw vases like Jim DeBacus does and make some noise. And you know, the trade-off is you don't get any legislation passed that benefits your district. You don't get, you know, funding for your district. And so it's a calculation, it's a trade-off, and I think Jim, by being the guy who was, you know, again throwing dishes around, could be the, you know, gave the other Democrats a little bit of cover. You know, they didn't have to be the ones saying these things. They could kind of work behind the scenes and get what they, you know. Karen Maine is a perfect example of the other approach. I mean, she's well liked among the Republicans. She gets a lot done and she does a lot for her district, but she hardly ever criticizes the Republican majority. So yeah, I think in that sense, Democrats are going to miss Jim being that big mouth that they kind of need up there. And it's going to be interesting to see what the delegates choose for, or who the voters choose to replace him, if they want somebody who's more like Jim or more like a Karen Maine.
One of the few offices the Dems get to hold in this state, I bet there will be no shortage of candidates coming forward.
It's a very liberal district. I think they'll pick a very liberal senator, and you know, it kind of remains. And I think there'll be a number of people who are going to be interested in running for this seat.
Okay. We'll see what the future holds for Senator DePacus as well. I want to go back to the state legislative session itself now, Dan Harry, and the budget windfall that lawmakers suddenly appear to have. It's a good chunk of money, a surprise, apparently. How much money are we talking about? Kind of a surprise?
You know, I'm not going to put numbers on it because it's so complicated. You're talking about ongoing money in, right, and one time. It's a lot of money. I mean, they have, you know, basically a half a billion dollars to put, right, into. But one of the big issues that they're struggling with is they're getting an $80 million windfall from the federal tax reform. So because the state tax is piggybacked upon the federal income tax, that means that without doing anything, the state will collect $80 million more in state taxes. So there's a lot of arguments going on right now. Do we do a tax cut to give that money back? If we do a tax cut, who do we give it to? Do we spread it across the board? Low-income people are going to get a bigger tax hike from this change, a state tax hike, than the higher income. So there are advocates for distributing it with a focus on lower income folks. Mm-hmm. So that'll be one of the big decisions. The other is sort of the usual, you know, a lot of the money will go to education, but a lot of it will be these sort of pork barrel projects that Robert has had a great time writing about in past years, where they kind of do this parade of begging for dollars, that they go in and they pitch these projects. And, you know, most of them are, I guess, very good projects, but some of them are questionable in, should this be something that we're using scarce public dollars.
Any examples of that this year, Robert, that you've been following?
The one example, I guess, that we've written about before is Mike Noel's $2 million request to sue California to try to force them to take Utah coal. Or power generated from Utah coal, and that's the type of thing that gets thrown into the queue. And then you've got the usuals. You've got like the Hale Center Theater, and you've got the Discovery Museum, and Leonardo comes up and asks for money every year. And so all of these museums, theaters, parks, you know, Taylorsville Days is the one that Jim Dunnigan always gets money
for. Don't criticize Taylorsville. Freedom Festival, are they up there?
The air show up at Hill Air Force Base, mm-hmm, is always asking for money. So that's the type of thing that they have to kind of prioritize. And what it comes down to is you're prioritizing the air show, for example, versus affordable housing or drug rehabilitation for Operation
Medicaid
Rio
coverage
Grande,
or birth Medicaid control coverage for low income.
You know,
women.
And they were talking about, for example, there was a $125,000 request, I think, for a study on wage disparities. And they're like, well, geez, we just can't. I don't know if we can fund that. But you'll see $125,000 go to these little pork barrel projects in a heartbeat.
And probably see that $2 million go for the California lawsuit, which the request was actually pretty much written by the law firm that wants to get that
specifically written by the law. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so that $2 million request will go right to that law firm. What's the opposite of a silver lining? A looming sign, anyways, that the last time the state had this kind of revenue numbers was 2008, just before the Great Recession. And this was pointed out by House Budget Chairman Brad Last. Is that, I don't know, is that something we should be worried about?
Well, I don't know if that's really a predictor of our economy. You look at Wall Street and the folks who do predict it, they're not very good at it either. So I don't know. Maybe you could use one of the animals at the zoo to predict it just as accurately.
Right. Well, it is kind of interesting. I saw something from, I believe it was Pew Report, if I remember right. But Utah has finally recovered to where its revenues are exceeding where it was before the recession. So we finally bounced all the way back. $500 million is what they say they have. As Dan mentioned, most of it is one-time money, so they can only use it for buildings or things like that. It's not maybe quite as much money as it looks like from the outside. But I think the one thing we know about the economy is we have bubbles, and you don't know you're in a bubble until it pops. Hmm.
Robert, we have to go to another break here in just a moment, but I don't want to leave before we touch on last week's, there was another mass shooting in Florida, in America, the latest mass shooting in America. We talked about it on the show last week. You weren't on the show, and there have been a couple of actions actually since we last talked about this on the show, namely the victims of the shooting themselves from the school shooting are calling for reforms to fix America's school shooting, mass shooting problem. That's a big change. There have also been some comments by lawmakers. You wrote about this, and as you have before and surely will again, this time, though, you asked lawmakers to essentially own up to their inaction.
Well, yeah. I mean, we hear a lot about people who are, wringing their hands and expressing their heartfelt, sorrow about these shootings, but they don't do anything. And if Sandy Hook didn't make them do it, if Orlando didn't make them do anything, if Las Vegas didn't make them do anything, if the Texas shooting didn't make them do anything, and if the Parkland school shooting didn't make them do anything, then they're not going to do anything, and they need to stop pretending to actually care. There's in Congress generally, and in Utah even, there's really not any discussion about, what reasonable steps can we take to try to prevent these things from happening in the future. I mean, after Las Vegas, everybody said, well, let's get rid of bump stocks. Even the NRA was kind of like, well, okay, we'll get rid of bump stocks. And Congress never took a vote. It's 4 months later, and Congress has never taken a single vote on whether to try to get rid of bump stocks. And Donald Trump came out the other day and said, okay, well, I think I'm going to ask Justice Department to get rid of bump stocks. That's good. That's maybe finally something that, but it's a very small incremental step. And so,
And one that didn't have anything to do with this latest shooting.
And no, I mean, this is looking back to the Las Vegas shooting, but it's frustrating and it's galling. And I think all of us are probably feeling some of that frustration that, and to be clear, there's not a simple solution to this. But we at least need to be willing to have the discussion, and Congress isn't even, taking that step.
Dan, Mike Lee was at the Utah legislature this week, and Senator Jim DeBacchus, who we were talking about just earlier, he asked Lee why we shouldn't ban AR-15 rifles. These are the weapons that have been used in 5 out of the past 6 deadliest shootings in the U.S. And Lee said that that couldn't be done without also banning hunting rifles. He said that he also said he didn't think the government could do that, sort of take over control of that sort of thing.
Yeah, he said that in a very roundabout way, a kind of a Clintonian, it depends on what the meaning of is. And, even Clark Apotian, who was the, best known gun rights activist in Utah, said, no, there are differences between the AR-15 and a hunting rifle, because a hunting rifle has a maximum allowed capacity of 4 rounds. And, we're talking 30 and 40 rounds with an AR-15. And that's one of the reasons people want to ban it, is because you have this incredibly killing machine that just can fire off so many rounds in such a short period of time.
Guys, we have to rush to a break just because we're low on time. And when we come back, we're going to have to go directly to our underplayed stories of the week to make room for a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune sports reporter Chris Kamrani, who is in Pyeongchang, South Korea for the Winter Olympic Games. But to a break right now. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back with our underplayed stories.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Jessica Miller, and Robert Gerke. And it's time to head to our underplayed stories of the week, guys. I'll just start with you, Dan Harry. What's your pick?
I'm going to go with Jim DeBacchus, who we've talked about, who presented a bill the other day in committee after having consumed two mimosas in the morning. And he did it to demonstrate that at 0.05 blood alcohol, you can function quite well. And he was his usual gregarious self presenting the bill, which immediately got rejected.
Okay,
the only openly impaired legislator. So this actually just broke as we were coming on the air today, but there's been a leak of some FBI documents that show that Kyle Kuzma, former University of Utah basketball player, got paid by an agent, violated NCAA rules during his tenure here. So that's going to be, and he's now with the LA Lakers, big shot with the Lakers now, and so that's something that we're going to have to watch unfold.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on it. Jessica Miller, your pick for underplayed story.
I'm going to pick a story that Taylor Anderson did this week about a bill that would require county jails and the prison to report to the state inmate deaths, which is kind of interesting because there's kind of a patchwork of what the counties are doing now, and this would define what an inmate death is. It's both in the jail and if you take someone to the hospital and they die, that's all included. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Okay. And we'll watch that as well. Jessica Miller, Dan Harry, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines.
Thank you.
Thanks.
For the remainder of the show, we are going to turn to a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune sports reporter Chris Kamrani, who is in South Korea for the Winter Olympics. Because of the time difference, this is a recorded conversation. To begin with, I asked Kamrani about Utah representation at the Winter Games. Chris Kamrani, sports reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, there in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Thanks very much for joining us, and good morning.
Good morning to you, Roger.
The Olympics are obviously in Utah's blood. Salt Lake City hosted the Winter Games in 2002, but also Utahns seem to be made for winter sports, Chris. How many Utahns are there participating in this year's Olympics?
It depends on what you want to define as a Utahn. We can go from 14 or 15 to as many as 65 or 70. For the born and raised kids, we're about 14 or 15. And then you have people from all over the country and also all over the world eventually move to Utah to work and live and train full time. On Team USA, there's about 65 or 70. Then you have internationals. There's about 10 to 15. So as you mentioned, you know, it's a hotbed for winter sports. There's so many facilities and infrastructures built in that state for people who want to chase this dream to relocate and do so.
Right. Well, Chris, where have we, you know, as Utahns really been excelling in Olympic sports this year? We've got the greatest snow on earth, so I'm imagining skiing is a big one for us. How are we doing there?
I think it's kind of been a mixed bag. The first 10 days or so were really rough for Team USA. There weren't that many medals. The highlight was, you know, Michaela Schifrin, the young prodigy from Colorado, but she's not a Utahn. Just Team USA in general really thrives when it comes to kind of the edgy sports, the X Games sports, the free skiing, the snowboarding. If there's one avenue that the world has a tough time catching up to Team USA, it's in those disciplines. They once again swept snowboarding, both in the half pipe and slope style. And just going back to, for example, yesterday there was the men's free skiing half pipe, and I think they had four guys in the top six and two on the podium in gold and silver. But the traditional sports, you know, alpine skiing, it's been a rough go. Lindsey Vonn was able to bronze in her last downhill event. But other than that, it's been kind of a hit or miss games. But, you know, you look at what happened yesterday or today, depending on how you view the time change, you know, the USA women's hockey team finally getting that monkey off their back and beating Canada in a gold medal game. You know, they lost the last two in Vancouver in 2010 and again in Sochi in 2014 to their bitter rival, and first gold medal for them since the inaugural Women's Olympics hockey in 1998.
Some sweet bit of, a sweet win for the U.S. women's hockey team.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, they said yesterday it wasn't necessarily about revenge, but it was a very intense game. A lot of people call it the best rivalry in sports, men's and women's. Olympic hockey with USA and Canada, and you felt it. It was a pretty electric atmosphere and, you know, intense. You know, Team USA went up and suddenly went down in the second period and needed a goal late in the third to send it to overtime. And it was decided in a shootout. And a lot of people, you know, are purists in sport and don't like the shootout necessarily, but it produced some pretty spectacular Olympic memories. You're going to be seeing that goal and some of those stops by the 20-year-old goalkeeper for a long time.
Echoes of previous Olympic hockey matches as well, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, and ironically, and in sport reporting, we love irony. It was 38 years to the day from the Miracle on Ice yesterday, February 22nd.
Wow.
So you'll see that popping up in stories for reporters who were there, undoubtedly.
Definitely. And Chris, just how are we doing in terms of the medal count? It's something that we all kind of fixate on during the Olympics. How's Team USA doing in that regard?
Let's just say we're not doing as well as Norway. The country that has just over 5 million people has 35 medals. Wow. They have 13 gold, 12 silver, 10 bronze. And it's impressive because they're doing it across all disciplines. Traditionally, you know, they're a skiing country. They dominate in cross-country skiing. They're strong in ski jumping. They're strong in biathlon. They're strong in even alpine skiing. But they are basically just running away with it here. And it's been, you know, kind of a mini storyline over here in Pyeongchang. We're in fourth place right now. We're at 21 medals. We're three behind Canada, four behind Germany in second place. That could change. The men's curling team upset Canada last night and has a chance to add to their medal tally one way or the other, whether it'll be gold or silver. It turned, Roger. They were not looking good. It was looking to be one of the worst games since Nagano in 1998 when they only had 13 medals. Right. But in 2 days, they've really rallied. And a lot of it has been on the backs of women Olympians. I think, you know, in one day you had Lindsey Vonn win a bronze and Keegan Randall and Jessie Diggins win the first ever women's gold medal in cross-country skiing. And the tides kind of turned there. So wow. It's looking better than it did just a few days ago.
Well, you're following the drama. I want to just, before we wrap up here, I can't get away from Salt Lake City figure skater Nathan Chen and his Olympic debut this year. I know that he started off with a little bit of a rough patch in his short program routine. What happened there, Chris?
You know, we've been following Nathan pretty closely the last year, knowing that he was going to be a big story for us. And, you know, the figure skating is the definition of the Winter Olympics, the eyes are always on the screen when it comes to figure skating. And, you know, Nathan was barreling into these games with so much hype and pressure and delivering. He went undefeated in every Grand Prix event he skated in the fall, and he dominated U.S. championships. And, you know, he has his own Super Bowl Sunday commercial, a whole minute long thing dedicated to him and his story.
Right.
And he got here, and for as much as his game face stayed on, he later admitted after the free skate where he bounced back that the pressure just got to him. And that's understandable, that you can't really come here and not expect to feel something that you've never felt before. And he said he tried to fight it as much as he could, but once he stepped out on that ice, it was a whole different ballgame for him. And while it was tough to watch that short program, he didn't land any jumps. He was in 17th place. He took less than 24 hours to basically kind of reconfigure, recenter, didn't talk to anybody, didn't talk to his family, just went to his hotel room and thought about it. And then the next day, you know, goes out and makes Olympic history by landing six quads, the first skater to ever do that in the history of the sport.
Chris, just to interrupt for a second, can you describe, for those listeners who maybe don't know, what a quad is?
A quad is just basically four revolutions. So think about, you know, everybody who's anybody knows what a triple axle is. It's three spins with landing on a certain edge of your skate. A quad can be is four revolutions, meaning it's one more spin, and then you vary the difficulty by where you land on the skate. It could be on the toe of your skate. It could be elsewhere. There's, I think, four or five different variations, and the quads in today's figure skating are rewarded by judges for points, whether they're landed or not, for degree of difficulty on their own. So the reason why Nathan was a medal contender coming in is because he can do more quads than anybody in the world. And he'd done five in a program before. Nobody had ever done six. Nobody had ever tried six. And, you know, Nathan goes into the second part of the program in 17th place, basically having no shot at a medal, and goes out and puts out the best skate of his career. And in retrospect, it's a bummer to think that if he landed just one of those jumps in a short program, he probably gets at least a bronze medal because he ended up in fifth place. But it was fascinating to see up close because he is a Salt Lake kid, even though he lives in LA now. And he had more pressure on him than pretty much anybody here at the Olympics. And it's interesting to see up close how, you know, an athlete of that caliber can run into the monster that is the Olympics and kind of get knocked down by it. And then, you know, he said, screw it, I have nothing to lose. And he came out and showed us what he's made of.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, I guess it's impossible to plan for that kind of pressure. Chris, just to wrap up this segment, is that the highlight of these games and any other, you know, major highlights that are going to stick in your mind forever from these Winter Olympics?
Yeah, following Nathan was really cool just because it was a roller coaster of 48 hours where we all thought that he had a shot at a medal and it was going to be this really fantastic story. But things don't go according to plan in sports, especially at the Olympics. And secondly, just being there for the gold medal women's hockey game yesterday was pretty unreal. I was lucky enough to watch the shootout in 2016 in Rio when Neymar delivered a gold medal for Brazil in men's soccer. And being able to watch another shootout on kind of that same caliber, same level yesterday with the stakes just as high was pretty cool as well.
Wow, some memorable moments. Chris, enjoy the wrap-up of the Olympics there. And thanks for covering it for us, and safe travels home.
All right. Thank you, Roger. Appreciate the time.
That's Salt Lake Tribune sports reporter Chris Kamrani. And that does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Coming up next on KCPW Presents Gun Rights, Gun Control, host Neil Conan delves into the history of the debate between gun rights and gun control with UCLA constitutional law specialist Adam Winkler. That's just ahead here on KCPW, if that is the station you are listening to. Thanks to KCPW's Jesse Ellis, Utah Public Radio's Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Holsey, and producer Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once more for tuning in, and we will see you next week.